Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about the long-term effects of demography and globalization on inflation. Here to discuss are two very special guests, Professor Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan. Professor Goodhart was the Norman Susnow Professor of Banking and Finance at the London School of Economics until 2002. He is now an Emeritus Professor in the Financial Markets Group at LSE. Prior to joining LSE in 1985, he worked at the Bank of England for 17 years as a monetary advisor, becoming a chief advisor in 1980. And in 1997, he was appointed one of the outside independent members of the Bank of England's new Monetary Policy Committee. Besides numerous articles, he has written a couple of books on monetary history, a graduate monetary textbook, two collections of papers on monetary policy, and an institutional study of the evolution of central banks. Our other guest, Manoj Pradhan, is the founder of the London-based independent macroeconomic research firm, Talking Heads Macroeconomics. His firm specializes in the analysis of global and emerging markets macroeconomic trends and their implications for financial markets. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Pleasure.
So we're very happy to have you both on the show today. Today, we will be discussing your book, The Great Demographic Reversal. Many of our listeners have written to the demand side asking about what we think about the future of inflation. So I'm very happy to have you both on to deliver your take. But before we get into some of the more technical aspects of the book, why don't we have you talk a little bit about the book and why you decided to write about this particular issue?
I'll give you a little bit of a background on how this happened. I think it started with Charles and I when we were both working at Morgan Stanley together in the economics team. And the discussion was very much centered around how interest rates would remain low for a very, very long period of time, as far as the eye could see, and how these cyclical stories had really trapped bond markets into a very difficult bubble, difficult to get out of. And Charles and I got to discussing and arguing that I think what markets are missing is that a lot of that bond bubble, or the bond bull market for bonds, falling interest rates, have really been driven in a very secular trend, not just with inflation, but with real interest rates falling, with lower wage growth and rising inequality with demography. And I think while people discuss the reversal of a very young society with plenty of workers separately as an independent story, it always seemed to be in the demographic domain. And we thought that what was coming upon us was not only the change in demographic dynamics in the global economy, but the fact that China's massive entry into the global economy was being still severely underestimated on the other side. As demography turned and as China no longer contributed as aggressively as it had to inflation, the things that people were taking for granted, what markets had priced in, would reverse. And we thought that was a very vital missing piece. The book itself builds up on that argument, but we've made it far broader because we thought it's a story. Aging is a story that touches every part of life. So there's a chapter on caring that we actually care a lot about, and about very broad-based effects of the reversal of demography that's coming upon us.
Right. So the main thesis of the book is that demographics and globalization were largely responsible for the deflationary pressure seen over the last three decades, and that these forces are now reversing. How have these variables changed? When do you expect inflation to be or to become something that we have to combat rather than something we are trying to achieve, like we have been recently? And what are maybe some of the other macroeconomic implications of your thesis?
So actually, when we wrote the book, we weren't really sure about when the story would turn, because if you look at global demography, the turn in the direction of the working age population of the labor force has started around 2010. And so we started writing this book. Most of it was finished by 2019. And at that point in time, we didn't really know whether inflation would come upon us within 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. We really didn't know. But then came the pandemic, and it accelerated, we thought, many of the trends that we thought would take a much longer time. And particularly, many different things have also appeared. We've seen monetary and fiscal policy, the scale of which we would not have expected, particularly when the shock that has caused the crisis is slowly receding as we all get vaccinated. So the secular story that lies behind here, we think, has already reversed. The support that inflation was getting from the integration of China's massive labor force, the baby boomers, and globalization, all of those three things are slowly already begin to reverse. But the effect sometimes lingers for a long time because these are institutional attitudes that take a very long time to change. For example, when you look at a manufacturing unit, probably what was going on behind the scenes was that China was a threat to any labor union that said, we want a 5% increase in wages. And the implicit threat was, well, if you do it, we're just going to ship everything across to China. And that threat can linger around for a very long period of time. So demography, we're pretty sure, is reversing and has already started its reversal. So the structural support that you had for falling interest rates is gone. But when you add to that, on top of it, something that we thought would take longer to change, which is the slow cyclical dynamics, which would allow a catch up with these structural forces, that has changed very, very, very dramatically. So the two dynamics I would point out that are really important to look at this reversal, not only has demography itself and the global working age population and the contribution of China to inflation started reversing a few years ago, but the cyclical change that we are seeing, in particular, two things to keep a lookout for. Number one, an increase in monetary aggregates that is tremendous. And in places like the US and Japan, it far outstrips anything we've seen for the last three decades. And number two, the speed at which the output gap is closing, while in some places, particularly the United States, the policy measures being put into place are far greater than what is required to close the output gap. That's really what we expect the inflation reversal to generate. On other effects, very quickly, we think we are entering some kind of a structural stagflationary story where growth will be low because of demography, but inflation will keep at a higher level. We think productivity will rise. So that's a benign part, but it's not clear that it will help to the extent that it brings inflation down.
Right. So I'm sure that you both are aware that these views are quite controversial in today's climate. You know, we've been in such a prolonged period of low or zero inflation that it seems it's hard for people, especially policymakers, to envision a world with inflation. I mean, we've seen some recent upticks in inflation recently, but how can you be sure that your predictions will pan out over the long term? What are perhaps a couple of input factors that have to happen for your predictions to be right?
Well, one of the hurdles, I think, we're already halfway over, and that is the scale and extent of the immediate inflationary blip when the COVID pandemic is overcome. Earlier, it seemed to us that central banks envisaged that the blip might be above 2%, but probably not much more than 3%. Well, the latest CPI figure is already over 4%, and the monthly increases over the last two months, month on month, have been very large. And our expectation is that although there is a lot of idiosyncratic variation from month to month, that this will continue. We rather stuck our neck out because our book had not yet been printed by the time the COVID pandemic actually hit. And we wrote an epilogue, tried to take some account of it, in March 2020. And we stuck our neck out by saying that we thought that the effect of the blip would be somewhere between 5 and 10% at a time when central banks were suggesting that it wasn't going to go over 3%. Well, it's already gone over 4, and we think that we're more likely to be right now than the central bankers were originally, although it was quite a brave exercise to say that it was going to be between 5 and 10. At the moment, it looks as if that may well come right. Now, of course, we can't be sure about the future. No one can. No one has a crystal ball. If I really knew the future, I wouldn't be talking to you. I would already own half the earth, and I'd probably be sitting on a Caribbean island, which I would own, drinking all kinds of wonderful drinks. But even so, the other things besides the scale of the initial blip, which I think is considerably higher than central banks thought, is how persistent it will be, whether it changes inflationary expectations, and whether it starts to change the scale of wage payments, labor contracts that get undertaken. I think it is already really changing the sentiment among those who set prices. Because of the very low continuing inflation, I think there was a tendency of many price setters to reckon that the default posture was to keep prices constant. I think the blip already is large enough that that default posture has been changing, and people are now thinking, what is our optimal price to set? And it's not necessarily going to be the same as it was last year. The rise in underlying prices of commodities more generally, the temporary at least shortage of getting labor to work for you in the service sectors, which are beginning to reopen, I think all of these will bring about a considerably larger initial blip, and it may persist.
So you talk about the secular stagnation thesis, and you say that it is wrong because it says the age of retirement will rise relative to the expected age of death, and that state benefits to the old will fall relative to the average income of workers. But what if the age of retirement doesn't rise? I mean, this secular stagnation thesis is sort of like the prevailing narrative. What if the age of retirement doesn't rise, state benefits don't fall, and deficits pay for the increase in old age spending rather than a dis-saving from the personal sector? If this were to happen, it doesn't automatically assume inflation, does it?
It doesn't automatically assume it, because there are steps that can be taken, policy measures, both to increase taxation and or to raise interest rates and reverse QE. But all those policy steps will be quite unpopular, politically unpopular. So we have doubts whether they will be pushed through. And when you were talking about raising the retirement age and reducing the benefits of state and other forms of pensions, some of that will be done. But remember, that's very politically unpopular as well. And after all, Russia's Putin is perhaps the politically most single powerful, well, after Xi Jinping, the most politically powerful politician in the world. But the one thing that he tried to do was to raise the retirement age, and he failed. In practice, as we show in our book, indeed, we've got a chart to show that, the gap between the age of retirement and the age of death, the expected retirement period, has been increasing steadily everywhere, all around the world, year after year. And the suggestion that this is going to be reversed, either by a rise in the retirement age or by an earlier expectation of death, I think is unlikely. And as for reducing the benefits, the pension and other benefits of old age, there are more old, and the old vote more than the young. And the idea that you can get away from the problems of aging by reducing the benefits that the aged get, it's not going to be politically easier to do at all. And our book is actually about political economy. It's about the political background and the idea that you can raise retirement ages and cut benefits to the old and not get a political backlash. It just ain't going to happen.
Right. So why do you think your story is not the prevailing narrative? You know, most of the time when economists look at low inflation, and especially in developed countries, you know, we blame automation, we blame the decline in union participation and yes, globalization, but demographics rarely are mentioned. Why do you think this is?
Well, first of all, demographics were very favorable until 2010, as Manoj just said. So it's a very recent development. Secondly, globalization is also a major part of it, with the rise of China, again, as Manoj has said. And there are two other important factors. The first one is that people, even now, with the extent to which we have a globalized world economic system, tend to do almost all their economics in terms of their own country, so that they haven't taken really sufficient account of globalization. And for example, all this stuff about the Phillips curve breaking down is very largely because China has, as Manoj would put it, has put the Phillips curve into a coma. And secondly, and very importantly, as I'm sure you'll ask us later, Japan has aged before any other country in the world. And Japan has had persistent deflation. So if there is a single word that explains why the mainstream hasn't taken our viewpoint to heart, is that they just use the word, single word, Japan.
Right. That's true. So to sort of summarize this for our listeners, in your view, what took place was a major supply shock to the labor market because of China's rise, coupled with globalization and demographic forces like women and baby boomers entering the labor market. We saw the actual bargaining power of labor greatly diminished, regardless of union participation rates. And as a result, we saw wages lag in widespread deflationary pressure. Is this a somewhat accurate summary of what's taken place over the last 40 years?
Actually, it's accurate enough that we could have used it on the back of the jacket, to be honest. It's very well put indeed. There are two nuances there that are pertinent to the discussion, and Charles has just mentioned one of them. The technical nuance that really carried the story home is the way China dealt with what's known as the impossible trinity, right? So you can't have free-flowing capital, you can't control the exchange rate and control the interest rate at the same time. So what China wanted was control over the exchange rate and control over domestic monetary policy. So they cut off capital inflows and restricted them very, very, very heavily. And that allowed them to set interest rates at such a low level that they could transfer savings over from the household sector to the banks and then from banks to the state-owned enterprises. The effect on the external global economy was that you could not really invest openly in China's financial market. So if you wanted to access this huge labor machine, you had to physically invest capital in there. And think about what that does to global dynamics. In a global sense, it moves investment from the advanced economies over to China, physically speaking. And so on a local basis within the advanced economies, ex ante investment starts falling quite a lot so that they have more savings than they know what to do with. And since it's the United States that sets the global interest rates came down everywhere. Within China, they were able to keep interest rates extremely low anywhere, and this helped them. And they were able to produce at a much lower cost than was possible. So you had global interest rates falling because of the way China dealt with capital flows. And the second thing was that, as Charles had mentioned before, really the effect of China was given a lot of attention, but not enough empirical importance. So when people talk about the Phillips curve and the Phillips curve flattening since the 90s, that is also the time at which China was lowering inflation. So think about what happens from a US point of view. From a US point of view, growth is fantastic. Yes, we move to consumption, but it's all great. It's all happening. Inflation continues to fall, which is even better. But if you start attributing that to the changing slope of the Phillips curve because of the central bank and so on and so forth, you miss the very important role that China had played in there. So everything you said was right. The only thing I would add in there was that it created a sort of complacency that this golden age would last forever and was something that had been engineered within the halls of Washington, D.C., rather than a global story.
So who were the winners and losers during this period?
Well, really, actually, it's a very difficult question you're asking, because there were winners and losers at different stages. It's only towards the very end of this period that the losers really became apparent. And it's really towards the very end that inequality got to a point where it led to a significant increase in populism. And the reason for that was, even though China had created a bifurcation in the labor market and the advanced economies, where people with higher skills and people who found technology to be a complement and hence worked better with it and they had their wages protected, they were going up north. And if you looked at the wages and real earnings of people who found technology and capital to be a substitute, they were affected very badly by China's rise and their real earnings continued to go south. But at the time their real earnings were falling, because interest rates were going down and house prices were going up, they had access to credit and they had access to the ability to purchase houses, which kept their purchasing power and their wealth as a household fairly well protected. And then came the global financial crisis and knocked off one part of it, where suddenly the housing sector and the wealth collapsed. And along with it, the willingness to take on credit collapsed. So we suddenly got to see who had been swimming naked, the people whose purchasing power had been taken away, and now their access to credit had been taken away, were so severely affected that their resulting decline really led to an increase in inequality and populism. But the two very important things that happened over this period is, number one, home ownership went up a lot, and those people will benefit for the rest of their lives. And number two, the inequality among countries has changed dramatically. So the flow of investment and the dramatic increase in exports has allowed emerging markets to outstrip advanced economies at least until 2010. And that is a permanent change that really we don't think will go back. And so we've had some real permanent winners out of this as well.
So let's dig a little bit deeper. Your book has four primary predictions. The declining growth rate of the labor force will cause a reduction in overall output. Inflation will come back. Inflation adjusted interest rates will rise and inequality will fall. Now, these predictions are, you know, as we know, quite a field from the consensus views in Washington. So can you walk us through why you think each of these things will happen?
Well, first of all, what you said is actually not quite right. We don't say it will cause output to actually fall. What we do say will cause the growth of output to be less. And in some cases, a few cases, output might actually fall, though that is really rather unlikely. In what is happening is that the growth of aggregate output is a function of the growth of the working age population and the proportion of that who actually become workers, interacting with the increase in productivity that those workers can provide. Now, the gist of our book is that the growth of the working age population is going to undoubtedly come down. And in some cases, and in fact, in particular, some of the fastest growing countries like China and Germany, the number of those in the working age population, the actual absolute number of those, will decline. Against that, however, with the reversal of globalization and the expected rise that we see ahead coming in labor costs because of the reversal of the beneficial supply shock, we think that there will be more investment in the advanced economies, so that productivity will actually per head will actually increase, and output per capita will also increase. And in many ways, you really ought to concentrate more on output per and overall income and output per capita than on what is happening to the total population and to the total aggregate. So that our picture is not quite as gloomy, because we think that productivity and output per capita will actually be rising. In practice, Japan has about the highest increase in output per capita of their workers of any country in the world. And we think that the remaining advanced economies will improve their output per capita and that productivity will be higher in future than it was in the past. The other thing that I would say that is not where I don't think you've got our message quite right, though our message is difficult, is about interest rates. We have no doubt that that nominal interest rates will rise. But certainly in the short term, it is very clear that nominal interest rates will, if they do start rising, will rise only very slowly and glacially, in part because of the enormous overhang of debt that now exists. If so, we expect that at any rate for quite some time, there is a likelihood that real interest rates, i.e. adjusted for inflation, will actually go down even more than they are at the moment, because you'll have you'll have inflation rising faster than nominal interest rates over the next few years. The situation is a bit more tricky at the long end, because as inflation starts rising and people come to expect that, the expectation will be that future nominal rates will rise. So we expect long nominal rates to rise considerably more than short rates, which will be held back by policy concerns. And that means that we expect the yield curve to steepen. So we're not absolutely sure in the short run whether long rates, real rates, will rise or fall. But the other arguments you make, that inflation will come back and inequality will start to decline within country inequality, are exactly what we do believe.
So let's talk about your take on dependence. You say dependence for the young and the old are purely consumers and hence generate an inflationary impulse, whereas workers can offset this inflationary impulse through production. If the growth rate of workers in the economy outweighs that of dependents, the world will go through a period of disinflation as it has for the last few decades. Over the next few decades, the rate of growth of dependents will outstrip that of workers. In level terms, the level of workers will still be greater than that of dependents over the foreseeable future, but it is the rate of growth that is changing throughout, and that's what matters. Is it possible that maybe we are putting too much emphasis on demographics and trying to explain what has happened over the last few decades? Even if the growth of dependents will be larger than the growth of labor, how can we be sure that the relationship between demographics and inflation will be strong enough to induce a resurgence of inflation?
You've got two pretty difficult questions in there. The first one has a simple and not so simple answer. The simple answer is, well, yes, of course, we could be wrong. We might be looking at trends that suit demography very well, and may just not hold for the future. Yet the difficult part of this argument is twofold. Number one, if you look at a theory and it tends to explain not just one fundamental process, but a couple of fundamental processes, and it's got some breadth in it, then I think you generally tend to put a little bit more weight in it. And that's what demography allows you to do. It doesn't just tell you about inflation. It tells you a little bit about how real interest rates have moved. It tells you a little bit about why inequality may have changed. And so the breadth gives us a little bit more confidence in there. The second thing is, if you look at the way these dependents and workers tend to behave, I think it matches the historical data very well as well. If you look at the rise in inflation, which happened when the dependents had not yet joined the labor force, particularly because of the baby boomers, the timing is such that as they started joining the labor force and China joined the global economy, the effects of what we would have seen from the passage that you just narrated actually do work out very well. Because if you look at workers will be hired by people only if we can pay them less than what they contribute in terms of output. And out of that, they'll be saving for the future. So their spending tends to be less than you would see out of dependents. One thing that stands in the way of saying that the link with inflation might be weaker is the people's expectation on two fronts. Number one, most people don't seem to believe that the elderly consume too much. Right. And on some things, they're right. You know, I'm not as excited about going hiking into the Himalayas or buying flash cars. I may still have a midlife crisis, but, you know, I'm kind of getting past that stage already. But what the data shows very clearly is that as you retire in the advanced economies, not in the emerging ones where healthcare is mostly done at home, in the advanced economies, elderly consumption actually goes a step up, a visible step up. And so just because they're not consuming on things that younger people consume doesn't make it any less. In fact, it makes it more dangerous because that's the kind of spending which, as Charles said, gets people to go to the voting booths and vote for governments who will allow them to spend on healthcare services, on a better quality of life after they retire. And if they can't do it, then governments are beholden to help them spend it. So there are two things I think that really give us confidence. Number one, that the increase in consumption that we are likely to see from here and the government's participation in that spending, if the elderly can't do it themselves. And number two, when you look at what people hold as a flashlight into the future, a lot of them depend on technology. But it's not clear to us that the link with technology into the future is going to be as deflationary as people think. It has been exaggerated in the past. It could happen, but the demographic transition, I think, is here and is definitely going to stay in place.
Let's talk about how this impacts the labor force. You talk about how aging populations will drastically change the labor force because in essence, there are so many elderly in need of being taken care of that, you know, workers will shift to elderly care, and many of the new jobs will be dedicated to caring for the elderly. And, you know, typically these jobs don't pay all that much. So how does the downward wage pressure associated with caring for the elderly and the increased bargaining power from a smaller labor market, how does that play out? Which force do you see will be greater?
Actually, I'm really glad you asked that question because I kind of glossed over a little bit on the technology point in the last one. I just didn't want to keep blabbing on, but this ties it in very nicely. So here's the issue. When people look at tech, they look at parts of the economy and hence the labor force in those sectors being completely decimated. And they're right. I mean, when was the last time we went to a travel agent? They just don't exist anymore. And a lot of people, we've seen small changes, right? Like simple electronic dashboards, which have made the necessity of having a switchboard operator completely redundant. Or news agents. I mean, you get everything on your phone these days. The issue is that we need technology to keep doing what it's doing over a period of time because we are going to have to reallocate, exactly as you said, people from the main labor force into looking after the elderly. So instead of looking at the wages of someone who is looking into the elderly as a standalone issue, I think what we need to do is to have this following chain of thought. Number one, Charles and I would both argue that it's almost impossible that technology or robotics or AI can look after the elderly by through electronic means. I think that's very difficult for either of us to swallow because of the personal experiences we've had with aging and neurodegenerative diseases in our family. If that's true, we are going to require an increasing number of people to be involved in what we call socially productive activities, looking after people who are part of our societies and have contributed, but they're not economically productive in the classic sense because they produce a consumption good which will be consumed this one time, and the elderly will then not go back to work to pay for it. Once it's consumed, it's gone. We could have got, through immigration, people to look after the elderly, and that would have led to no real need for internal allocation. But I think that ship has sailed. Immigration, especially on a large scale, is almost impossible, which means we need people from within our economy to be shifted to looking after the elderly. And at the same time, almost perfectly, technology is busy destroying jobs at the skill level, which is the same as that would be used to look after the elderly. So what we see over here is a reallocation. If we didn't have those jobs looking after the elderly, the jobs that technology destroyed would have created a significantly larger deflation because you would not have been able to absorb those workers anywhere else. So far from being a deflationary story, it gives you job protection. It does not really open itself up to automation destruction, and it gives you a steady income over a period of time. We think it's only a matter of time before a lot more people look into nursing jobs or some way looking after the sectors that look after the elderly. It's not as deflationary as it looks at all.
But, you know, you talk about how immigration could solve this, but, you know, are we really sort of running out of workers? I mean, you know, here in the U.S., we have pretty low labor force participation. Isn't it possible that Marx's reserve army of labor could come to fruition and create a disinflationary price pressure?
It's a good point. It's a very good point. And indeed, that could happen. As you mentioned right at the beginning, the participation of women was a game changer in the advanced economies. It rose significantly. And if you look at the participation data, participation of the elderly has started rising 20 years ago. Some of this can already be seen in there. The difficult part for us is we wonder how far it can go, given how far it has gone already. Let me explain what I mean. In our book, we have a case study in Germany, where Germany had for decades almost, until the mid-2000s, tried and tried again to try and reduce the burden on the government of looking after the elderly. Then in 2003, the Rurup Commission tabled very strong reforms that looked like they would really go through. And if you look at Germany's participation rate in a very important cohort of the population, those between 55 and 64, so the pre-retirees who knew their retirement was coming within a decade, before the Rurup Commission's recommendations were tabled and approved, the participation rate in Germany in that cohort was 45%. 45%. I mean, that's a really low participation rate. After that, it has gone up in a straight line to over 65%. And if you look at the advanced economies, at one time or the other, very similar forces have taken place and they have raised the participation rate to between 65 and 70%. Now, these guys are going to retire within 5 years, 10 years. If you already have a participation rate of 70%, it's very difficult to see how many of them will rise and continue to keep working and show a significant increase in participation beyond that. A lot of that juice has already been taken out, and we are already seeing the benefits of that right now.
Well, let's keep going. I want to talk a little bit about public finances. If your predictions are right, and interest rates are on an upward path, and output growth is going to be reduced, what does this mean for public finances? Which countries are you most worried about?
Virtually all of them. It's easier to mention countries I'm not worried about. And Germany for one, I think probably Switzerland. But there are mighty few countries where the debt ratios are now greatly higher than they've really been. They're not greatly higher than they were at the end of World War II. But do remember that wars were temporary, and the expectation which was justified was that after war was over, that public finances would come back on, shall we say, a relatively prudent path with relatively low primary fiscal deficits. The difference now is that what's causing the deficit and the debt, which is essentially the aging of society, isn't temporary, it's permanent, it's structural, it's actually going to be with us now for decades. If you look at the predictions for the government's public sector debt ratio, for example, in the USA, the CBO prediction that was made, Congressional Budget Office prediction that was made, I think it was last August, what you will see is that the pandemic, COVID pandemic, produced a relatively short-term blip in the scale of the debt, but that the upwards trend thereafter has nothing whatsoever to do with COVID. It's to do with the aging structure of society. And that means that if you take the present policy structure, virtually all the major advanced economies are currently embarked on an unsustainable upwards path. And something has to give at some stage. And it is going to be difficult. The obvious answers are cut back the benefits to the aged, which we've already discussed, politically very difficult. Raising taxes, and you can't just, there aren't enough wealthy to just do it by raising taxes on the wealthy. It's got to be raising taxes on everyone, including the workers. And think how unpopular that will be. And if you can't raise taxes, well, then you could raise interest rates. But that has fairly unpleasant side effects, both on the fiscal balance again, and also in the fact that the private sector, non-financial corporations, are in many of our countries, most of them, in fact, are also so highly indebted that any sudden, quick, or extensive rise in interest rates could not only massively reduce the value of financial assets, it could drive a significant proportion of our corporates actually into insolvency. And that would do nobody any good because it would reduce the tax take because of a recession. So it's trouble. One of the things that actually does worry me is this argument, don't worry about inflation because the Fed or the central banks can deal with it. But remember, or at least most of those who were too young should at least know, that it was extremely difficult and it took a great deal of political courage for Paul Volcker and Ronald Reagan to raise interest rates sufficiently to beat back inflation at the end of the 1970s. And a difference between then and now is that the debt ratio at the end of the 1970s was probably only about half what it is now. So it was difficult to raise interest rates at the end of the 1970s. Think how much more difficult it will be to raise interest rates significantly now.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we can certainly agree on is that, you know, taxes won't be raised to account for old age spending increases. I don't think retirement ages will be adjusted either to cover the cost. But you know, like you said, this is just a political reality. But you know, if politicians are unwilling to do those hard things, then don't they have to accept the fact that central banks will raise rates if inflation, you know, trends upward? I mean, you know, you say in the book that central banks may be forced into keeping rates low because of deteriorating financial positions, but that isn't guaranteed, is it? I mean, the central bank could raise rates and the state would just have to borrow at higher rates, which isn't good, but You know, it's also not really a problem for states with full monetary sovereignty. I mean, Euro states with high debt loads could face balance of payments crises, but Japan and the U.S. would probably be fine. When you talk about interest rates and fiscal positions, are public finances your main concern, or is it that by raising interest rates, the corporate and household sectors will become vulnerable to insolvency?
All of the above. And you talk about central banks being capable of raising interest rates to whatever it takes. But do remember Nixon asking Arthur Burns to keep interest rates low so that he could get reelected. Think about what Mr. Modi in India, what Ms. Erdogan in Turkey. Increases in interest rates are not that much more politically popular than increases in taxation. The one reason why Maggie Thatcher was very opposed to giving the Bank of England independence to vary interest rates was that she said, to some extent, I think correctly, that it didn't matter whether it was an independent central bank or whether it was a government that raised interest rates, that the government would take the blame for the nasty things that happen when you raise interest rates, mortgage rates going up, housing prices going down, companies going insolvent, the fiscal requirements rising, and so on and so on. And when governments take the blame, they tend to try and put pressure on central bankers not to do things that will make them governments unpopular. And with the exception of the ECB, which is protected by a treaty, ultimately what one government or legislation can propose, another one can change. The independence of central banks is a much more fragile wand than I think most people realize. And if central banks start doing things that make life difficult for both prime ministers, presidents, and secretaries of state for the Treasury, they will respond in ways that will curtail the independence of the central bank. And one of the sort of final arguments of our book is that perhaps the glory days of central bank independence are behind us.
Very interesting. You know, in the book, you talked about fixed income durations and the debt trap, which I really enjoy because I've been harping on that for years. Obviously, there's a need for treasuries to issue substantial short-term notes for the maintenance of monetary policy. But a key failure, in my view, is that treasuries didn't take advantage of low rates while they had the chance. You know, if rates are going to rise, which I think is likely because they can't be low forever, many countries have squandered an opportunity to improve their public finances. I mean, in the U.S., this is Mnuchin, Liu, Geithner. I mean, they all dropped the ball. You know, in my opinion, they didn't issue enough 30-year bonds. They didn't even really consider a 50-year treasury. They said there wasn't enough demand for one, but I think that was sort of just a cop out. So can you talk a little bit about the debt trap and how it could have been better navigated had longer durations been issued?
I fully agree with you, and I think the situation is actually worse than you set it out, because the duration of the debt in the hands of the private sector has to take account of the effect of quantitative easing, or QE, in effect of shortening the duration of the debt. Because through QE, the central bank has been issuing a lot of very short-term debt, really sight debt, I demand debt, largely held by commercial banks, in exchange for buying much more long-term government T-bonds, with the result that from the viewpoint of the public sector as a whole, i.e. that is including the Federal Reserve within the public sector, the duration of the debt has actually been going down because of the massive increases in QE. Whereas you rightly say, at a time when interest rates have been exceptionally low, we should have lengthened the debt. So we've been traveling in exactly the wrong direction with regard to debt issue. I think that there was a great misapprehension about QE. QE worked very well and I think was essential with regard to liquidity problems. But in terms of affecting the other problems of the COVID pandemic and of the great financial crisis, I think it had much less effect, and we would have done much better off had we had far less QE than we now have built up. And the balance sheet of central banks have just grown ginormously at a time when what we should have done would have been issuing 30, 50-year bonds to the private sector as a whole.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about some counterarguments to your theory. The most commonly cited counterargument is the case of Japan. You know, we talked a little bit about it earlier. Aging affected, you know, neither inflation nor real interest rates there. So, you know, those who were concerned about Japan's, you know, ballooning debt to GDP ratio, and this leading to hyperinflation, you know, they turned out to be quite wrong. So why are you convinced that the case of Japan can't play out elsewhere?
Actually, it's probably the most important question we had to answer before we started writing this book. Because if Japan really was a map for the future, then really our story could not hold at all. But the deeper we dug into Japan, the more we were convinced that actually people had looked at it the wrong way. So, you know, if you look at behavioral economists, they have a very simple hypothesis called the narrow framing hypothesis, which is if I give you two pieces to connect, you won't really look for a third piece to explain part of that puzzle. Whatever you've got in front of you is what you'll connect. And I think when people looked at Japan, they saw demography, they saw all the effects you spoke about, and the argument was, well, one must have created the other. And actually, that's not right. Japan happened, if you will, Japan's demography turned at a time when the rest of the world was swimming in labor. And what we've seen with the work we've done in our revisionist history, we've got an entire chapter in the book called Why Didn't It Happen in Japan? We were trying to answer that very question. Is we saw that the forces that China and demography had unleashed upon the world, Japan was not immune to. It was not an economy in autarky, even though it is studied as an economy in autarky. It was a very open global system. And essentially, Japan's disinflation was at least partly, if not to an even larger extent, the same kind of disinflation that the world was going through thanks to China's integration. So if you look, for example, at the way Japanese debt dynamics work out, so you look at Japan's rising debt, you look at interest service ratio and where interest rates have gone, Japan doesn't look unique at all. It looks exactly like Germany. It looks exactly like Italy, like the United States, like Great Britain. Everything shows you a very similar dynamic, yet we single Japan out. But you think about the following arguments. The main argument we make in there is that at a time when Japanese government debt was rising, Japanese corporate debt was falling very sharply. So the picture we have in mind is that the Japanese corporate sector was really crumbling, and it was going through this period of introspection and really shutting down and was really a very, very placid force. If you look at the data of Japanese corporate activity outside Japan, the picture is completely different. So we went through 20 years of Meitei data from annual reports about how Japanese corporates had invested abroad, and we saw a striking picture. Rather than looking like a really burdened part of the Japanese economy, Japanese corporates invested heavily, they produced aggressively, and they employed aggressively outside the United outside Japan, particularly in China. If you look within China, within Japan, what you see is a picture of adjustment that does have some unique Japanese characteristics. For example, their productivity was excellent. The output per worker that we saw in Japan over that period, where Japan is supposed to be a failed economy, was actually better than most advanced economies. The adjustment that happened in the labor force was a function of a few things. Number one, they moved far more aggressively people from manufacturing to services, to a point where they pride themselves on having three or four people walk you to your table when you enter a restaurant. Most of the adjustment happened through wages, through hours, not through wages. And finally, Japan adjusted its labor force by moving more people from full-time work into part-time work. And that made the labor bargaining process much easier and far more against the workers. If you look today, no one has an escape valve like Japan did with respect to China. Most economies are aging and aging together. It's very difficult for them to find a way to find another new China that's really taking the pressure off anything that might be happening at home. So rather than thinking of Japan as a roadmap, we have to think of it as an economy that went through a very difficult demographic transition, but was able to cotton on to this massive demographic boom in the rest of the world and change its strategy accordingly. It's definitely not something that we think will happen to the rest of the world.
Very interesting. So the future won't look like Japan. I think I can accept that. And we're no longer seeing China as a deflationary force. But going forward, couldn't India or Africa take its place?
It could, but there are some impediments. The difference, I think, is threefold. Number one, when China arose, the rise of China was made much easier by the fact that the U.S. economy was very, very open to offshoring, very, very open to globalization, and hence the capital flow into China was very, very smooth. That's not the era in which India and Africa are going to emerge, if you will. We're very positive about growth over there, but the point that we don't think is convincing is that they can take on the role that China had. In fact, we might even end up needing three Chinas, and that seems even more difficult. If you look at India and Africa, there are a few differences as well that are quite interesting. For example, the Chinese economy, one of the key things that it holds is that the system of apprenticeship and guilds and training has been with them for centuries, really. And they have the ability, therefore, to disseminate information, which was made much more aggressive by state sponsorship and the physical movement of labor and capital was also assisted by state sponsorship. If you look at India, it's possible to have that to some extent, but Africa has a much harder time with that. There are 50 states in Africa with a population the size of India, and that means a coordination of 50 national different strategies, which just seems very, very difficult to envisage. Even in India, the arguments between the center and the state, and some of that has been highlighted in the way the administration has mismanaged the COVID pandemic, those make it very difficult for a coordinated effort like China to take place. But perhaps the most difficult part is that both these states, both these parts of the world, India and Africa, they lack administrative capital. What the Chinese authorities were able to do very aggressively is to use national strategies to find national champions and state-owned enterprises, to have a national macroeconomic system of transferring savings from the household sector over to banks and then from banks to state-owned enterprises. That kind of single-minded strategy looks very hard to implement in either case.
Interesting. So I'm gonna try to sum this up for our listeners. Your thesis is that, you know, we started with a savings glut, but since there will be more elderly who need care, there's going to be less money dedicated to pro-growth opportunities because those funds will need to be directed towards caring for the elderly. And then you couple this with fewer people in the workforce producing goods and services, and companies needing to invest more in capital because of a shrinking workforce, there will be a decrease in the amount of funds available, thus a decrease in savings. This then will cause an increase in interest rates, slower growth, and because of the sheer number of elderly, there's going to be a noticeable increase in inflationary pressure, resulting in stagflation. And because of this slow growth, central banks won't raise rates. Thereto, inflation will persist. So what happens if, you know, those, what happens if states deficit invest, you know, for the future? What, for example, what President Biden is doing right now, you know, he's using deficit spending to invest in infrastructure and other areas that have, you know, high economic multipliers. And it seems that growth is coming back. You know, there's been, you know, as Charles mentioned earlier, quite a recent uptick in inflation. But, you know, isn't this a model that I guess others can follow? I mean, deficits don't automatically mean inflation. And if you're taking, you know, a country's savings and using it on high economic multiplier projects, this only refills the saving coffers, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, if they're able to find investment projects on a persistent basis where the rate of return is higher than the cost of capital, and they're productivity enhancing so that they're able to lift the labor force beyond what it normally would have been able to produce, you'd be absolutely right. And in some cases, I think that is going to happen in a few projects or the other. In others, it might be a little bit more difficult. The point that we would make over here, the thing that makes it difficult is that a large part of the increase in debt and deficits over the next few decades is related to aging and spending related to looking after the elderly. So out of that, you could get medical breakthroughs, because usually when that kind of money flows into the medical sector, the incentives to raise productivity in that, well, some call it inefficient, I would rather call it labor-intensive sector, are going to be quite high. And some of the things that you try and do to make the lives of the elderly people easier might end up benefiting the young as well. But this is all a hope. Right now, one of the most difficult propositions that we've got that make this spending necessary is that we have not seen any real improvement or progress at all on treatment for neurodegenerative diseases. Until such a treatment is available, an increasing amount of government spending is going to go into facilities and institutions that look after these people and help them to lead as good a life as possible. As I said, there could be some spillovers from medical benefits that come out of it. We're not sure, and hopefully we will. We'd love to be wrong under these circumstances. But as things stand today, it doesn't look like the bulk of spending will go towards the activities you describe. If they do, we'd be very happy to be proven wrong. In fact, one of the things we'll be looking out for is when we come out of this pandemic, what is the state of the corporate sector? Has it become more efficient as we think it should? Or has productivity there remained the same? But as far as government spending is concerned, we worry that it will be increasingly directed towards activities that don't really, really need to a massive increase in productivity in the economy. So that would put a little damper on depending on every project that is financed by governments to give you a rate of return which more than pays for itself.
Yeah. You know, when we look at forward guidance, you know, I think that, you know, recently it's shown that the central bankers are going to let the economy run a little hot. I mean, you know, they've said that they're going to let inflation rise above their targets. But I don't think that they will let it get out of control. I think that central bankers would probably choose to tighten like Volcker did if things got out of hand. I think that this, they would think that would be the preferred course of action if, you know, if interest rates got out of control. I think they would choose that over letting stagflation persist. This would lead to a low growth, low inflation world with higher costs for treasuries. But I just, I don't see them letting it get out of control. Why are you certain that they are going to be forced into that outcome?
Well, you can't be certain about anything that's going to happen in the future. However, I think that they've painted themselves into a bit of a corner, because they claim to be so certain, it's them who are certain rather than us, that inflation will be only a transitory blip, and it won't be that blip, won't be too high, and then it'll go back very easily, without much effort, to 2%. And it's them who are certain, not us. And it is quite possible that in the short run, with them determined to hold interest rates at zero and not to start tapering on QE, that it is perfectly possible that inflation might get so out of control in the short run that inflationary expectations start to change, and the whole behavioral ethos about seeking higher wages to offset expected inflation and adjusting prices more frequently could change back towards the kind of conditions that we had in the 60s. And what's more, the other point is that, as I said earlier, the political downside of higher interest rates is very great. The analogy that I like to take is that the role of a central bank will be like crawling along a very narrow ridge. And you could fall off on one side by not raising interest rates enough so that you get inflation becoming persistent. But you could fall off the other side by raising interest rates so much that the forces the economy back into recession. There's a very, very narrow pathway. We cannot be sure about how central bankers will react and how the politicians will allow central bankers to react. But what we are fairly sure about is that the path that they will have to tread is going to be much more difficult, much narrower, and much harder to manage and operate than anything that they've had to deal with over the last 30 or so years.
Well, I think your thesis is certainly worthy of the academic community taking another look. It's your approach is heterodoxical for sure, but if you're right, you know, you've changed the nature of economics, and I think you're both worthy of an I told you so. I think, you know, economists need to take a deeper look at demography, and your book has forced us to do that. It's very illuminating, and I hope all of our readers go out and grab a copy. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
It has been a pleasure.
Well, the questions were really excellent. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thanks for having us.
Well, that's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Inflation is Closer Than We Think with Charles Goodhart and Manoj Pradhan. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.